and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The New Hampshire primary results are in. A very, very big win for Bernie Sanders, the Democratic Socialist running for the Democratic Party, and for Donald Trump, who came back from his second place finish in Iowa to win by a large margin. We are joined by independent candidates, third party candidates, Jill Stein running for president on the Green Party, and Gloria LaRiva, the presidential candidate for the Party for Socialism and Liberation, to discuss the New Hampshire primary results, what they mean, and what's coming next in the 2016 elections, an election year that is anything but conventional. Welcome, Gloria, and welcome, Jill.
Great to be here.
Thank you for inviting us, Brian.
Jill Stein, let's just start with you. The results are really resounding for Bernie Sanders on the left side of the aisle. Sanders beat Hillary Clinton among nearly every demographic group in the Democratic New Hampshire primary, according to exit polls. He carried majorities of both men and women. He won among those with and without college degrees. He won among gun owners and non-gun owners. He beat Mrs. Clinton among previous primary voters and those participating for the first time. And he ran ahead among both moderates and liberals. Hillary Clinton won with people over the age of 65 and those with a family income of more than $200,000. Quite a big victory for Bernie Sanders, given the fact that he was considered the liberal outsider just a few months ago. What do you think?
Well, I think there's a rebellion in full swing. And, you know, whether it was inside the Democratic Party or inside the Republican Party, where an outsider also won by a huge margin. And likewise, polls tell us that there's a revolt going on in which people are dropping out of the two big parties. And what you see happening in New Hampshire is that independent parties are basically wiped off the map. And New Hampshire does not allow independent parties basically to participate in a primary or to hold a primary. The only way an independent candidate with an independent party can have a primary actually is to have won at least 4% of the vote in the prior governor or U.S. Senate election. So in other words, it's you get grandfathered in, and if you are a new party and an independent party, you can't be a part of it. And this is unfortunate because it sort of sets the tone for the nation that there are only two pigeonholes here and people have to get stuffed into them. And I think what we see clearly happening in both parties is that there's really a revolt at the margins of the party. And the question is whether the parties, both of them, will allow these candidates, you know, to go forward and to continue riding these waves. You know, and I'll just say, you know, in my view, these revolts are very important, but it's really hard to build a movement inside of these two corporate-controlled parties. And you can look back to the Democratic convention where Henry Wallace was about to have been nominated, and they shut the microphone off on him, and then suddenly, you know, the convention was called off. It was reconvened the next day, and there came Truman. You know, so the party and the control, the corporate control of the party, the deep state, the military industrial and security complex, you know, the whole sort of corporate global apparatus has a very deep hold on these parties, and it will take a very deep and long fight. The worry is that, you know, if Sanders doesn't get it, he has pledged to campaign for Hillary, to work for Hillary, you know, to support her in every way possible. You know, it's just worrisome. What reason do we have to trust the Democratic Party that they're going to deliver, that they will allow Bernie to prevail? And if he does, that the fight can actually be fought and continued and built.
Let's bring Gloria LaRiva. She is the presidential nominee of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Let's bring you in, Gloria, into the discussion. Jill's making the point that the two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, have a very tortured history in terms of exclusion of progressive candidates, that it largely ends up as a graveyard for progressives, that it really can't be a vehicle for change. I want to talk about that issue, but I want to first talk, if we could, to focus in on what seems to me to be a remarkable support for Sanders, what Jill said was a revolt within the Democratic Party. I mean, Sanders' program is attacking the Wall Street banks. He says we have to stop the political establishment. He calls for a political revolution. He says the problem in the United States is that the 0.01% of the population has the equivalent wealth of the lowest 90%, which isn't a low, that's most of the country, that the top 20 richest people have the equivalent wealth of the bottom 50%, which would be 160 million people. 20 people have that kind of wealth. That message, whether it's within the Democratic Party or the Green Party or the PSL or any party, that message of extreme anger against Wall Street is resonating and has brought to the fore a candidate who seemed to have absolutely no possibilities just a few months ago. What do you think about it? What does it represent? Not what does it mean about the Democrats or whether it's a good strategy to be in the Democrats, but what does that revolt mean? What does it show?
Well, first, I'd like to say something about the vote tonight. It's not all completely in, but Sanders did win overwhelmingly, and it's certainly clear that he is capturing the overwhelming percentage of young people. It's not because he's young, that's for sure. It's the demands he's raising, not only that he's saying socialist, and I think people are voting for him despite that, but for young people, there was a poll in Miami where a lot of young students were saying that they agree very much with him on the issue of free public education and that they espouse the ideas of their parents who were anti-war. And it's a real rebellion. And in addition, the attack on Sanders this last few days by Hillary Clinton in bringing Madeleine Albright in and Gloria Steinem, who made these really disgusting comments about young women and women voting for Sanders as if it was a betrayal to not vote for a woman. Madeleine Albright, who is a total war criminal, and it boomeranged actually back on Clinton. There was a lot of feedback, negative feedback on what she had done. She's clearly failing in trying to bring out.
How is Madeleine Albright a war criminal?
Well, when she was Secretary of State, she fully backed the bombing war of Yugoslavia in which thousands of people died and, you know, 600 state industries were destroyed. She was Secretary of State under Clinton when a million people died in Iraq. And I was in Iraq. I made a documentary called Genocide by Sanctions and visited the hospitals where in hospital bed after bed, women were there with their children who were emaciated, just skin and bones, babies who didn't know what sanctions were about, didn't know about politics, but were already dying. And this was Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes at that time was shocked when she walked through the streets of Iraq and visited the hospitals. She asks Madeleine Albright, I mean, this is more children than died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Is the price worth it? Madeleine Albright says, this is a difficult question, but yes, we believe the price is worth it. 1.5 million people, mostly children and women. She has no right to speak up for women in this country or anywhere in the world. And then I was in Yugoslavia during the bombing war in 1999 for 10 days with Ramsey Clark. We walked into a hospital where a young woman, the blanket was put over her head because she had just died. A 15-year-old girl that we met had become paralyzed by cluster bombs dropped by the United States. So this really boomeranged on Hillary Clinton, who was laughing when Madeleine Albright was speaking on her behalf. But I want to get back to the issue of Sanders and the vote tonight. It's very interesting that from way behind came John Kasich to finish second in the Republican primary Of course, Trump finished strongly with more than 35%. But just when he started to slip last week in Iowa, here comes the media pumping him up again. And I was astounded to watch on CNN Sunday that they gave him at least a half-hour lengthy chat by telephone talking to him where he was able to call. Trump called for waterboarding and said, and I'm for much worse, meaning much worse torture, without any kind of a pushback from the media. So the media is playing a very big role in promoting Trump. It's all still quite early, but the next race is South Carolina, and I think we'll see a lot of interest there because it's a much stronger black population. It is the South, and Clinton tonight was definitely directing herself to the South, speaking with a much more left progressive tone, but it's all talk.
Jill Stein, I was watching the Republican debate on Saturday, and the moderator, this was right after the DPRK, North Korea, had set off a satellite into space. The moderator said to the Republican candidates, North Korea just tested an intercontinental ballistic missile and they want to strike the United States. That turned out actually to be completely wrong. But she said to them, will you support a preemptive war against the DPRK? A number of them said yes. In other words, an actual war of aggression against a country that possesses nuclear weapons. In the Republican Party, it is a revolt when people are supporting Trump, but it seems to have an extreme ultra-right sort of tone by the candidates. I saw a poll today where most Republicans, when asked about whether they thought immigration was important in the Republican primary, thought it was not important, but most of those who talked about it thought there should be a path to legalization for immigrants. In other words, a different tone from the candidates. Why are the Republican debates so extreme right-wing? I mean, it sounds like it makes George W. Bush sound like a liberal.
Yeah, it sure does. On preemptive war towards North Korea, there was a question asked of the surgeon Ben Carson several debates back about, you know, would he tolerate, as a pediatric surgeon, you know, would he tolerate bombing and mass deaths of children in wherever it was, Iran or Syria, or, you know, did he have the tough stuff, you know? And he says, you betcha, you know. And I mean, the kinds of presumptions, like, you know, Gloria, as Gloria mentioned, Trump saying, you know, waterboarding would be just the beginning. It's really very frightening. And I think, you know, it sort of represents in a nutshell how when people are very economically stressed and insecure, that people can go in either direction. We're sort of seeing that now, you know, that you have this enormous openness to socialist ideas, or, you know, to dismantling the banks and attacking Wall Street and Medicare for all. And there's a big rally for that, as we see under the Sanders banner. And at the same time, there's incredible sort of immigrant bashing and warmongering going on beneath Trump and Cruz. And it's a really good illustration of how when people are very sort of vulnerable and insecure, you know, demagogues can do incredible danger and harm. And it makes it all the more important, I think, that there be, you know, a really strong and unrelenting conversation that lifts up progressive values, lifts up humanism, lifts up international law and human rights, and that we get to, you know, the underlying causes of the immigration crisis instead of talking about building walls and prohibiting Muslims from coming into this country or establishing a database for Muslims or immigrants. You know, we need to be talking about what's driving the immigration crisis, which is, you know, fundamentally predatory U.S. policies, NAFTA, the war on drugs, the wars themselves, and military coups, whether in Latin America or regime change in the Middle East. You know, you really need to tell the truth, and you really need to have an agenda that reassures people so that people understand you know, they have a right to a job. They have a right to living wages. You have to speak to people where they are and their insecurities in order to preempt this kind of fascist agenda, which could otherwise really get going.
Gloria Lariva, the Wall Street Journal said it was possible that there could be an extreme political outcome, meaning that the Democrats and the Republicans could have either a very liberal candidate like Bernie Sanders, or the Republicans could have someone like Donald Trump, who seems to be, while part of the billionaire class, untethered to the Republican Party establishment politically. He's not taking his directions from them, and they don't really favor him. His base is really from below. If that were to be the case, and there's talk about it now, that the establishment, the political establishment, might be so desperate to have somebody who is like a reliable, vetted, stable part of the establishment, because the maintenance of the electoral system as a two-party system and one that produces a suitable candidate for the powers that be, Wall Street banks, that there's talk about Michael Bloomberg entering the race as a third-party candidate. If that were to be the case, do you think, first of all, do you think it's likely Bloomberg as a person was the three-term mayor of New York, a Republican turned independent, a billionaire himself? But do you think that that would change the equation at all for parties like Jill and the Green Party, or your party, the Party for Socialism and Liberation? I mean, in other words, is there an opportunity here in this political cycle where things can be completely undone, and not completely undone, but undone enough so that new space opens up politically?
Well, first, if Michael Bloomberg were to run, it would be an indication of the extreme crisis for the Republican Party, because imagine that the ruling establishment, which favors at this point the Republicans in this race, would be challenging the Republicans because it's out of their control now to see Trump, Cruz, Rubio vying for each other and possibly winning the nomination. I think it would open up big opportunity for us, not because we would be posing ourselves against Bloomberg, but because the idea of an independent campaign would make it possible for us to talk. And yet, I think this about Trump. The people who are supporting him for the most part are poor, insecure, feeling great fear about their future, even suffering unemployment and poverty, poorer white people generally, who fall for racist, demagogic ideas that Trump, you know, saying, I'm not afraid to attack the politicians, you know, I'm not a standard politician, I'm from the outside. So he's got a lot of buzz and support. We see that tonight in New Hampshire. That's exactly why third parties, progressive third parties like the Party for Socialism and Liberation, the Greens, must go there to reach those people who right now are being captured by Trump. We must fight for their loyalties and ear as well. We have to show them that Trump is a demagogue. He is against them too.
We're going to come back after a short break. We're talking with Jill Stein of the Green Party running for president, and with Gloria Lariva running for president for the Party for Socialism and Liberation. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and clear. Loud and clear.
We are back. We're talking with Gloria Lariva, Party for Socialism and Liberation presidential nominee, and with Jill Stein from Boston, who is running for president on the Green Party, or trying to get the Green Party nomination. I'm not sure if it's a completed process yet. Jill Stein was the candidate for the Green Party in 2012. We're talking about the New Hampshire primary. Gloria was just saying, Jill Stein, that the independent candidates had to go not just amongst the liberal people who are supporting Bernie Sanders, but with working class white people who might be confused by the demagogy of somebody like Trump, people who may be poor, may be hurting from the economic conditions and subject to the demagogy. I think you were saying something similar. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. You know, we're in very difficult economic times. We're told that, you know, the economy is recovering, lots of jobs are coming back, you know, but the reality is that these are mostly part-time and temporary jobs. They're low-wage jobs. In fact, wages have generally been declining, and average workers' wages are now barely above poverty level. 40% of workers are making under $20,000 a year. Household wealth has crashed by 40%, and that's on average, and it's much worse in the communities of color. So, you know, people are having a very hard time, and in fact, you're seeing now this rise in mortality among older white working class men, and now I believe among younger white working class men as well. And much of this is related to, you know, drugs and alcohol and depression. You know, people are really taking it on the chin right now, and it's at times like this, exactly throughout history, that people become very susceptible to demagoguery, to the kind of divide and conquer, you know, messages that try to split people and, you know, sort of profiteer politically off of vulnerable groups like immigrants. So it's really important that the message of economic justice, of jobs and good wages, really be front and center. When we talk about you know, the economic crisis, and in fact the climate crisis as well, we try to really put jobs first all the time to help reassure people that this is not a matter of saving the climate and, you know, and forgetting about jobs and, you know, the welfare of families and so on. And in fact, we talk about the right to a job and ensuring that everyone has the right to a full-time living wage job in an economy that's working for people, for communities, and for the planet. And we put together the green emergency together with the emergency of the economy such that we reach 100% renewable energy by 2030 you know, ensure that everyone has a job, creating an economy that works for all of us and that can survive the climate. And we put out in front student debt, you know, not just free public higher education, but abolishing student debt and getting, you know, students back into an economy that works for them. It's really critical that the economic issues be put front and center. And, you know, when we do that, I think there's no end to where this could go. And I think, as Gloria was saying before, and you were asking about, you know, in your question, Brian, the fact that Bloomberg may enter the race, that Trump, if he doesn't get the nomination, may very well run as an independent, suddenly it's going to be okay to be running as an independent entity. And I think that does create political space for third parties to come forward. And the real message that we have to drive home is, if you're running under corporate money and you're running as a billionaire, basically with corporate money, it doesn't make much difference, you know, what your label is. You're still representing the 1%. And it's the real parties of, by, and for the people, like the Green Party and the Party of Socialism and Liberation and, you know, the various socialist parties. That's really what needs to be lifted up. And that's what the establishment is really terrified of, because we will really drive this home, not only with economic justice in our economy, but with, you know, an end to imperialism and the war economy and the war budget, which is basically sucking over 50% of our discretionary dollars into the black hole of the military, which is making us less safe, not more safe.
Gloria LaRiva, I want to pick up on that same point. Bernie Sanders has a very progressive liberal program, not really socialist in a traditional sense, more perhaps social democratic, more like democratic liberalism. But democratic liberalism more or less got snuffed out in the 1990s when Bill Clinton came in and said big government is the problem. They exorcised the word liberal. It wasn't bad to talk about being a socialist only. You couldn't even say you were a liberal. They called it the L word. They got rid of welfare as we know it, as they said, and 7 million kids got dumped off of welfare. The free trade agreements, which are really investors' bill of rights, allowing corporations and banks to just take millions of jobs out of the country. I mean, the left wing, the liberal wing of the Democratic Party was kind of squelched, and now it's coming back, and it represents a great enthusiastic response from young people, middle-aged people, working-class folks, increasingly from the Black and Latino communities who Sanders had no base with but is starting to get more and more support. But when it comes to foreign policy, Sanders says, you know, I stand with Israel. He's not as unqualified in his support. He's more critical. He's more liberal. But he says, I'm for drones, but we should use them judiciously. He said tonight we voted against the Iraq war. But is there a fundamental difference in foreign policy from Sanders and Clinton from your point of view?
I don't believe so. I mean, I think Clinton is more open about what she's willing to do. As soon as the Iran agreement with the United States was made on the nuclear issue, Clinton immediately said, I want more sanctions. I want to impose sanctions, which in fact did happen. But right now, the Obama administration, by the way, has presented its plan, its proposal for the military budget, which is an increase over this current year because it includes a $59 billion operation for Iraq and Syria. And Obama wants to triple the cost of heavy weapons to Eastern Europe directed against Russia to almost $4 billion. Sanders, it's interesting to see what he's saying. I think it's very worrisome what he says because, as you said, he is for Israel. He voted for the emergency bombing funds that all the Senate voted for to send emergency weapons so that Israel could continue murdering people in Gaza. But the other day, in a debate, he said that Assad of Syria is a brutal dictator. And that is an indication that he would continue the continued policy of saying that the Syrian government is not legitimate. Continuing the funding, I believe, for the terrorist organizations, the so-called opposition, which has also created throughout all these years of U.S. war and occupation in the Middle East, the perfect medium for the organizations like the IS, the Islamic State, to grow and be nurtured in the vacuum and the destruction of the secular states over the years. The U.S. Aggression against Iran. And I think that Sanders also has spoken in very negative terms about North Korea, sometimes mocking when he said, oh, socialism doesn't mean that you're going to all be wearing pajamas like North Korea. And he speaks very negatively about Korea, which is really under the gun by U.S. imperialism and South Korea. The fact that they launched a satellite but is being touted in the media as having threatened the U.S. with missiles is completely false. And he is not going to try to clarify that or say, no, that's not true. And as you said he's for limited drone attacks. Well, that right there is a denial of the right of other countries to have sovereignty and independence. It's the U.S. deciding who dies and who lives, who gets put in rendition prisons and tortured. So I think the fact that he's not speaking forcefully against all U.S. military aggression and actions, sanctions, blockade, is problematic and is part of the Democratic Party politics. That's why as socialists we say we're against any action of U.S. aggression. There's nothing defensive or any kind of humanitarian nature to U.S. military action. In fact, we're for the complete dismantling of the Pentagon, and the only part of the Pentagon budget that we're for is the funds to be used to completely dismantle the nuclear weapons that exist and to provide for funding, education, training, jobs for the veterans, for veteran medical care, which is so desperately needed.
Yeah, Jill Stone, I want to go back to you. I think foreign policy, it's very easy for people to discount the centrality of foreign policy. But when you live in the United States of America, which took over from Great Britain as the empire in the world, it didn't have colonies per se, it has some, but it had 1,000 military bases all over the world, and it uses economic power and those military installations and other means by which the United States has enormous empire-like influence. It's not possible really to have a progressive agenda that says, okay, we're just going to fight for bread and butter issues at home and ignore what the United States, what's the government that's speaking in our name does abroad. It reminds me a little bit of what happened, and I'm speaking a little bit longer on this, but I want you and Gloria to talk about it. When Martin Luther King was able to get the Civil Rights Act passed, along with the millions of black people and their white allies who were fighting for civil rights in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, he did that in partnership, really, with Lyndon Baines Johnson, the liberal Democratic president from Texas. And Johnson's speeches, if you look at his 1965 inaugural speeches, very, very liberal, in fact, as what Sanders is saying. But at the same time, he started increasingly waging war against Vietnam. And ultimately, Martin Luther King, under great pressure not to do so, broke from Johnson and said, you can't really have justice at home. You can't have a war against poverty at home and have a war against poor people abroad in Vietnam. And he made that speech in 1967 at Riverside Church, where he broke from Johnson and said, we, the civil rights movement, must stand with the people of Vietnam and other colonized people who want to be free. I mean, that was such a radical message, I would say, in contrast to what we're hearing from even the most liberal Democrat.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that's where the Sanders agenda is close but no cigar, because you cannot create, a just and sustainable America if you have, you know, a policy of total economic and military domination around the rest of the world. We need to have an America that works for us. We need also a world that works for us. You just can't have it both ways. You know, you can't dominate the world and then have justice at home. And the point you made about, you know, wars against poor people around the world that Martin Luther King, you know, just had to stand up against, you know, that poverty around the world has become all the more extreme now, where 62 billionaires, who are largely in the U.S., now have the wealth of half of the world's population, 3.5 billion people. And this just, you know, isn't working. The vast majority of the world, I think it's like 85%, lives in truly deep, deep poverty. And it's largely the U.S. and Europe that don't. And this is absolutely unsustainable. And with 1,000 bases around the world in over 100 countries, you know, it's just this is a staggering situation of empire. Our military budget, which is 53% of our discretionary budget, so dominates. It's not just that it's 53%. The next biggest portion of our budget is 7%. You know, so it's like the core of it is militarism, and then
And what is that for? The 7%.
There are a variety of 7% expenditures, and they include housing, education, government services. You know, this does not include Medicare and Social Security, which are
entitlement. They're the allocated earmarked money, but discretionary funding, the budget that is approved every year by Congress, 53% is what you're saying goes to the military.
But also, I'd like to say also that that percentage of military spending is going to increase continually. And what was not mentioned by Obama in his State of the Union message, but was clearly stated in the New York Times the day before, they thought he would say this, is that the U.S. is planning $1 trillion more on top of the current budget over the next 30 years in what they call smart nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. They're saying that they can dial them down. They're trying to make them palatable for the public, but they are nuclear weapons that would be directed against the same countries that are being attacked now by the United States. This is very, very dangerous situation that we're being placed in, and why, without an international policy and program and demands against all U.S. intervention abroad and shutting down the bases and bringing the troops home and having a peace economy and also helping with reparations to the countries that have been destroyed, without that kind of a struggle, the people of the U.S. can be attracted to a program like Sanders, who says we need jobs at home and education. This is all true, but you have to link it with the international issue. You can't have jobs at home if you're having wars abroad.
We're going to pick that up after a short break. We can have both of you address that very, very centrally important question. We're talking to Jill Stein of the Green Party running for president and Gloria LaRiva of the Party for Socialism and Liberation also running for president. Two important voices from third party candidates, but we'll be back after a short break.
Loud and clear. And clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking to Jill Stein of the Green Party running for president in 2016 and Gloria LaRiva running for president on the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Jill Stein, let's go back to you. We're talking about can we have jobs at home and wars abroad? And that is an important issue because Sanders' surge, which is so exciting, I think, for people who want change, who are sick and tired of the establishment, also people can become the victims of self-deception or deception if they don't think through, well, what is the candidate actually saying about foreign policy? Because it will translate into very, very big issues, not just for the people internationally, but for the people here. Go ahead, Jill Stein.
Right. And I think it's really important to stress here that this is why we need an open debate. This is why third parties need to be included who are not held hostage by corporate contributions and by the deep state that operates through both of the corporate parties. If people, you know, have a chance to actually hear this issue vetted, you know, the revolt that's taking place among the American voter right now, I think, you know, has much deeper potential to go further because the logic here is so compelling. The $6 trillion that the U.S. has spent over the past 15 years in these wars on terror, which have only created more terror, you know, has devastated our economy. And that $6 trillion turns out to be $75,000 per household. When people hear that, you know, in the same, you know, context of knowing what a disaster these wars have been, and sometimes people need to be reminded because they're being fear-mongered all the time about how we have to go bomb ISIS. But the reality is, you know, bombing ISIS will only create the next ISIS. And in fact, you know, Al-Qaeda grew out of the chaos in Afghanistan, and we created the international jihadi movement, actually, the CIA and the Saudis together basically created international jihadism in order to thwart the Russians in Afghanistan. You know, this has been a cycle over and over again, and it's become more intensive from the Mujahideen, the Taliban, that became much bigger in the course of that Afghanistan fight that we were helping to arm and the Saudis were funding, and then Al-Qaeda grew out of that. In the course of the Iraq war, Al-Qaeda became a global threat, not just a local threat anymore. It became a global force, and it's been, you know, all downhill from there. So when people are reminded of that, and the fact that we have spent $6 trillion, we have lost tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers who've been maimed and killed, and that a million people were killed as a part of this war, let alone the sanctions. But in the war, a million people were killed in Iraq alone. This is absolute devastation. It has only produced failed states. It has produced worse terrorist threats, and it's produced an absolutely massive humanitarian crisis and the refugee migration.
Let me bring Gloria back in. Gloria, I want to keep with the same theme here about foreign policy, but also its connection to the domestic policy. You have Hillary Clinton running for president. Now, she was the one demanding that the Obama administration begin the bombing of NATO. And sure enough, it did. Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, showed hesitation. He said, well, Libya is not in our vital interest. There seemed to be some reluctance on Obama's part. But Clinton was really part of the cheerleading. And when, after thousands and thousands of bombs and missiles were dropped on Libya, Gaddafi was finally captured. He was lynched on the street, a terrible, disgusting lynching of a 70-year-old man. And she, that day, said, we came, we saw, he died, and she was laughing, like giggling, and it was on video. I mean, she was the Secretary of State. Wouldn't it be good for the Green Party and the Party for Socialism and Liberation, the progressive independent third parties, to bring that issue up in a big way right now and say, first of all, what did Clinton mean by that? Because now we have ISIL, so-called Islamic State, dominating big parts of Libya. But also ask Hillary, ask Bernie Sanders, well, what about Libya? What about what Hillary Clinton said? What about the fact that she demanded the bombing and thus the destruction and thus the fragmentation of Libya, which led to the creation of ISIL? Wouldn't that help put both Sanders and Clinton on the spot and bring it back to an issue that they obviously don't want to talk about?
Yes, exactly. And even though Sanders has got huge support among, let's say, young people, for example, and young people tend to be anti-war, he's not saying anything about it, which again is another indication of how problematic his support is, where he's ignoring completely. But he's not really ignoring the international questions. If he let's assume he became president, if he's a supporter of Israel, he's going to go along with whatever they're doing, because it's not the tail wagging the dog. The United States continues to finance Israel by $3 billion and more every year with weapons and illegal occupation of Palestine. And we also have to look at Hillary Clinton and what she is saying now about she's obviously the warmonger, but in terms of what Jill Stein and I should be doing, we are doing that right now. I issued a statement yesterday, which has gotten a lot of coverage and is going around on the media, exposing Madeleine Albright, condemning to hell young people who vote for or support Bernie Sanders. And
based on her having supported the killing of 500,000 Iraqi babies.
Yes, and talking about her whole war program during the Clinton years. But under Obama as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton was part of the planning of the coup of Honduras. And she never denounced that because she was for it. The whole program of Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton before her, and she supporting him, has been the Democrats' continual move to the right ever since really the very end of the Jimmy Carter administration. And it's not just because they're Democrats, it's because they are the twin party of imperialism, which is continuing to build an empire, trying to build an empire, destroying states that they consider independent from U.S. domination. And I don't really think that Bernie Sanders represents a challenge to that. He doesn't.
I want to ask both of you the same question, if I could. And that it has to do with the banks, because that's the focus of Sanders' campaign. He's like ranting and railing against the Wall Street bankers. And of course, they should be ranted against and railed against because they torpedoed the economy. 9 million people were in foreclosure. 3 million lost their homes. Tens of millions lost their jobs. And the government bailed them out with no strings attached. And yet these same bankers who are becoming ever richer, the chairman of the J.P. Morgan just announced a big raise for $300 million in the coming year. Oh, Sanders is talking against the banks. Good. Okay. A lot of people hate the banks, as they should. But he says, let's break up the banks. But is it possible that this kind of monopoly capitalist domination of Wall Street, where you now have six big banks, can they be just broken up and to become demonopolized? And what's the Green Party program and what's the PSL program for what to do about Wall Street? What's the solution? Jill Stein.
Okay, great. And first, I just want to make one last comment about the foreign policy stuff, which is just to note that the Sanders campaign, Bernie himself, stresses that Saudi Arabia should do the dirty work in Syria. And I just want to say that is, you know, that's just not compatible with a livable world. This is about more, you know, absolutely insane foreign policy. Saudi Arabia has been funding and arming terrorist groups. It may not be ISIS this week, but, you know, it's been al-Qaeda and al-Nusra. And, you know, this is just not, this continues to put a flamethrower to the Middle East. We need a weapons embargo, which the U.S. can lead because we are providing the majority of the weapons to the Middle East, largely through Saudi Arabia, who then distributes them to all other parties. So So we need a weapons embargo, and we need to impound the bank accounts of the Saudis and the other countries that are basically supporting jihad.
Okay, let's go to the banks.
Great. Okay, on the banks, you know, it's there too. It's, there's a deep state around the banks, you know, and finance as there is around the military. And it's going to take a big movement and a very big push. I don't think it's going to happen inside the Democratic Party. Now, there is a, there's been a really wonderful proposal for breaking up the banks, which actually comes from Bill Black, the guy who wrote the book about the best way to rob a bank is to own one. And he was one of the regulators in the SNL crisis. And he's actually proposed an agenda that can be conducted entirely through executive action, so that if an independent third party, Green Party, Socialist and Liberation candidate were to win the office of the presidency, they're at, you know, with a huge public mandate to support actions, it would actually be possible to break up the banks, mainly by imposing on them these so-called individual minimum capital requirements based on their risks related to their size, to their non-commercial banking activities, in other words, their reckless gambling, executive compensation, and so on. But you know, essentially, it has a way of imposing real restraint on banks based on their size and reckless behavior.
Let me bring in Gloria. I want to cover a couple more topics before we end. So, Gloria, go ahead. And what's the PSL position on Wall Street banks?
Well, we believe that the banks should be seized, taken over under people's control. And there's a perfect reason for it. They're not only involved in driving people into homelessness, Brian. They're not only involved in criminal operations of, you know, amassing profits and using the $700 billion bailout to get even larger and merge with other banks. They also are part and parcel of the drug trafficking operation worldwide that's caused death and destruction. Wachovia in 2010 admitted that they had laundered $378 billion, not million, billion dollars of drug money. There are U.S. laws that prohibit, you know, depositing more than $10,000 in a day. They were depositing billions. And so they should be seized and taken over. I don't think we can wait until Jill Stein or myself or another socialist or progressive wins the presidency. It should happen now, and we can do that through political agitation, organizing. The people hate the banks. The problem is there has to be a program of a resolution on this crime that they are carrying out. Just a few years ago, was it 2008, we are still paying for that bailout. The taxpayers are still paying. And the practices which led to that banking crisis have accelerated. There's another banking crisis on looming before us. And so what's going to happen then is the perfect time for us in our campaigns to raise the crisis of the banks, the criminality of the banks, that they caused the crisis, that they continue to cause a crisis. They got bailed out. They kept the property of the homeowners, drove people into homelessness, and they're richer than ever. So that's why we say seize the banks, take them over, use the finances to provide free education, free healthcare, to build the infrastructure. It's not just Flint that's suffering from lead poisoning, but hundreds of towns and cities that need a whole new restructuring that will cost tens and tens of billions of dollars. The banks have the money. It belongs to us.
I think, you know, I think breaking up the banks, you know, through minimum capital requirements or whatever technique should go hand in hand with also nationalizing them, because we should have public banks at every level, at the level of communities, states, and nationally, so that we actually have public control over the money supply, over credit, over lending, so that we can undertake, you know, critical community projects and actually cut their costs by 50% if these are actually public banks.
Yes. And I think idea of seizure is interesting. The federal government does seize illegally begotten wealth all the time. I mean, billions and billions every day, and a lot of people's wealth every day at the local level. There's a lot of seizure that goes on. But the idea of seizing banks, of course, might require a political revolution, which is what Bernie Sanders is getting so much support for when he says a political revolution. But we don't really know what he means by a political revolution, except we know that it resonates very well with all sorts of people, and especially young people. They voted 80% or 85% in Iowa, 85% in New Hampshire. A plurality in Iowa said they would be perfectly happy to a majority said they'd be happy to have a Democratic socialist president, and a plurality said that they were socialists. I mean, there's a lot happening right now. There's a lot of anti-Wall Street, anti-capitalist fermentation. But what is the political revolution? I mean, we have about 3 minutes left. I want to give each of you 60 seconds on what is the political revolution that you're talking about, and then I'm going to just have a few final comments.
Well, we call for a political, social, and economic revolution. You have to have all three together, especially based on the economy. And our call is for a socialist revolution, a socialist economy where everyone's needs are guaranteed, that the needs for a human being of education, healthcare, housing, culture are required rights, guaranteed rights, and not commodities as they are under capitalism. It means that it will take the struggle of the people. Only the political struggle, organized movements of people has ever made change in this country, from tearing down the apartheid of the South, Jim Crow, to ending the war, to winning women's rights. And even gay marriage was won by people's persistence in demanding equal civil rights. But we call for socialism. I think the ideas, the campaign of Bernie Sanders is helping in that regard. But we have a lot more to go in our campaign this year to talk about what socialism really is.
Okay, and Jill Stein, 60 seconds.
So, you know, the political revolution, as Gloria said, you know, it needs to be economic, social, and political. Another way to say that is that we need to put the cause of people, planet, and peace over profit. Right now, profit domineers all. We need to flip that. As Gloria said, the real driver here, the engine of this change, is a social movement. But that social movement deserves a political party, so that this struggle is not one person, one revolutionary candidate inside of a counter-revolutionary party. It will be basically, you know, over before it's hardly begun. We need to have a really deep movement here that needs a political voice. In the words of Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. There needs to be a very deep and relentless, ongoing, continuous, enduring demand here in the form of, you know, truly transformative parties like what Gloria and I are talking about here today.
Well, this really is a different political year, and it comes after the Occupy movement. It comes in the middle of the Black Lives Matter movement, the immigrant rights movement. There's a lot happening in the United States and around the world. I'm sure people, if they got a chance to hear you on CNN, MSNBC, the main networks, they'd say, Gloria LaRiva, Jill Stein, yes, their programs speak to me. Right now, of course, you're not on the mainstream media, but in 10 seconds for both of you, how can people find out about your campaign?
To vote for Gloria LaRiva and support our campaign, you can contact us at votepsl.org.
Okay, that's the Gloria LaRiva PSL campaign. And Jill Stein?
Go to jill2016.com and join the team.
Okay, thank you so much. We've been with Jill Stein of the Green Party running for president, and Gloria LaRiva running for president on the Party for Socialism and Liberation. We'll be back tomorrow. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.